Let's continue with our look at God's distinctiveness. We've looked at a lot of different areas: transcendence, unapproachableness, glory, righteousness, truth, jealousy, and the last one that we're going to talk about is God's wrath. And this is one that is very commonly associated with the Old Testament and the God of the Old Testament. And so many times when people who have not really studied Old Testament theology at the Baltic Methodist Theological Seminary, when they look at the Old Testament and the God of the Old Testament, and this includes many Christian preachers, they see a God who is very much a God of wrath and punishment, and not so much a God of mercy or grace or something like that. So it's important to understand the notion of God's wrath in the Old Testament. Because when you see the wrath of God aroused, it is against sin. Now, later on in the course, we will talk about sin and the different kinds of words that are used in the Old Testament with regard to sin. Let me just take two of those concepts to fill in here to help illustrate the aspect of God's wrath. One concept of sin is failing to measure up to being equal to God. And a second concept of sin is to be in rebellion against God. Now, there are other words, but these are two of the major ones, and two that I think it's very important to use when we're trying to look at the concept of wrath. Because God's wrath is against that which resists Him and sets itself up proud and with great pride as being equal to God. And so this destroys the possibility of fellowship with Him or participation in His holiness because of these ways in which people have acted. Against the Gentiles, most of the time God's wrath is against their acts of injustice. And you can see a very interesting thing in the prophets. When the Assyrians were attacking Israel, the prophets said that they are the instrument of God to punish Israel for her sin. But the prophets go on to say that in fact, the Assyrians themselves would be punished by God because they considered it was their strength and their power and their gods that gave them the victory over Israel rather than Israel's God allowing that to happen for His purposes. And so they went way beyond simply being an instrument of God's wrath for the sin of Israel. And they, in essence, enslaved the Israelites by taking them captive, dragging them back to the Assyrian center in what today is Iraq, and then forcibly spreading them out until the majority of the people in the 10 northern tribes disappeared ethnically from any identifiable existence. Well, God says that the Assyrians now would be punished, they would experience his wrath for taking advantage of this opportunity and doing far more than was right. In other words, for acting in an unjust manner, or an unjust manner. And so by doing that, they set themselves against not only God's people, but by their pride and their sense of self-achievement, they set themselves against the holiness of God. And so they would experience the wrath of God. But the wrath of God is also against Israel for some of the same reasons. Israel was, in one way or another, during most of the prophetic period, under some kind of general rebellion against God. After Solomon's death, the northern kingdom intentionally split itself off from the southern kingdom. And the new king intentionally created two worship centers, one in the far north and one in the far south of his northern kingdom of Israel, so that the people would not go to the temple of Yahweh in Jerusalem to worship. Because he was afraid if they went there, then they would push for the political recombining of the northern and the southern kingdoms into a single people of Israel again. And that was the beginning of a gradual resistance in the northern kingdom to being the people of Yahweh anymore. Because more and more they grew distant from the laws. They didn't participate in the ceremonies anymore. They more or less created their own form of Israelite religion according to their rules and their ideas rather than what God had given the people of Israel, which was centered on the temple in Jerusalem. Well, the Israelites then, the northern kingdom in particular, was more or less, after Solomon, constantly in some sort of rebellion. Not only political rebellion against a domination from Jerusalem, but also spiritual rebellion against the God that had delivered them and brought them together and prospered them in the land of Israel and who was worshiped in Jerusalem. It was not just these people, though, that were in rebellion against God. The southern kingdom had similar problems of being in rebellion against God. Especially do you see this at two particular points, both in the time period after Hezekiah. In the early time period after Hezekiah, who was king around 715 to about 680 BC, after Hezekiah, his son Manasseh became king. Manasseh had been raised in a relatively peaceful, prosperous environment, what I like to call fat, dumb, and happy. And Manasseh had worshiped the gods of other nations until the Assyrians took him into captivity back to Assyria, and he suddenly realized, this isn't good. And he was eventually released to go back to be the king of Judah. But when he went back, he actually had repented while in the Assyrian prison. And he did try to undo all of the apostasy that he had introduced into Judah. The problem is, not everybody wanted him to undo it. And so it continued. Later in that same century, a descendant of Manasseh came to the throne as a child at a time when the temple of Yahweh apparently had actually fallen into complete disuse. Apparently, bushes had grown up in the court of the temple and maybe some trees here or there, and they had even forgotten the location of the law and these sorts of things. And when Josiah became king, one of the first things he did with the assistance of the priests was to cleanse the temple and to restore the worship of Yahweh. And so during that century, it went from a high point under Hezekiah to a way low point where the worship of Yahweh was apparently just totally neglected while the people worshiped other gods, to Josiah, who was able, until his life was cut short, he was able to restore the worship of Yahweh among the people. But these were all evidences of this rebellious spirit that God's wrath would stand against. So you have the wrath of God against the foreign people for injustice. You have the wrath of God against the Israelites for their essentially open rebellion against God. And this is where, more than anything, you see the wrath of God being pronounced by the prophets in judgments against the foreign nations as well as against the Israelites. And you see this some in Isaiah, you see it some in Jeremiah, you see a little bit of it in Ezekiel, and you see it in some of the historical books in the Old Testament. Anytime there is the pronouncement of God's wrath, you always find the reason for it. God does not just say, "I'm mad at you." We might do that. But God does not just say, "I'm mad at you. I'm going to punish you." But God always tells the reason. And the reason is always the specific sin or sins that are bringing his wrath. It is not because you are a particular person or group of people. Because God's desire, as we know from the New Testament, is that all should be saved and come to a knowledge of the truth. God was never focusing his wrath on people. It was the sin that those people were committing. And this was the case in the Old Testament. Whenever you see the wrath of God, it is for particular sins. As I said, basically the two I picked out were pride and rebellion, which are two of the most serious. In contrast, so that you understand the difference between Israel's God and the gods of the other peoples, The pagan gods, the world of polytheism, saw the wrath of the gods as being completely determined simply by the choice of one or another of the gods. And their wrath did not have any system to it, did not have any structure to it. They simply set themselves against humans to use them and to destroy them. In fact, among the other peoples of that day, the gods were using people just like pawns, little chess pieces on a chessboard, to use them and then throw them away. And very often you would see stories of a strong man who was greatly strengthened by the gods, and then when they were done using him to do whatever they wanted, they just arranged for him to die. And there was no reward or anything else. He was just gone. And that was the end of it for him. Well, the wrath of the pagan gods was what is called in English capricious. It was without design. It was unpredictable. It was just whatever that god wanted it to be at that particular moment against that particular person. And most of the time, the wrath of the pagan gods was against the person. Whereas when the wrath of Yahweh occurred, it was against the sin, not the person. So we can kind of sum up something of God's holiness in sort of a chart. And let me put this up on the board because it may be helpful to you. God's holiness is in two different directions. First of all, he is transcendent. Meaning he is wholly other. But God is also immanent. Meaning that he lives and dwells among us. God was righteous. He was a just judge. He was, in a sense, legal, which is to say, he was always the same in what was required. It didn't change from time to time. Unlike laws in our nations and our countries, his law always was the same and did not undergo various interpretations and changes due to interpreting it one way or interpreting it another and so on. But at the same time, God says to the Israelites, He is a father. And you can find, I've got a series of references if you want to look these up. You'll find that God refers to Himself as a father to Israel. It's in Deuteronomy, it's in Malachi, twice in Isaiah, and once in Jeremiah. And these references are to show that while in this way God is separate from man, God is also very present and involved with humans, especially the people who are His chosen people, Israel. God is unapproachable except by invitation. But God is also personal. Which is to say, He is unapproachable unless you are invited. But God invites. And when God invites, you as a person are welcome to approach Him. And this includes such things as the cultus, the temple cultus of the Israelites, and these sorts of things. For God, law is absolute, and yet there is flexibility. One of the very interesting things that occurs in the Old Testament is when David first begins to flee from Saul, one of the first things he does is he goes to the tabernacle. And you remember the table of showbread, where there were loaves of bread. They were replaced every week by the priests. He goes into the holy place where only the priests are supposed to go, and he takes the bread from the table of showbread with him as he begins to flee for his life from Saul, who wants to kill him. Now, under the law, David should have been taken and executed for violating the law of God that allows only the priests to go into the holy place, and for taking the bread on the table of showbread and using it for himself when it was already holy and it had been put there only for God's purposes and God's use. And yet instead, what happens is that there is no condemnation. There is only the report that David did this and nothing further. And so while the law was absolute, it was also flexible, because there may be situations which are more fundamental than what the law specifies. I'll tell you at least one other one in a minute. Sin is any transgression but sin is specifically a transgression of a known law of God. Now, what does this mean? Well, any transgression means that technically, whether you know what you did was sin or not is irrelevant. If it was a transgression, it was a transgression, and therefore a sin. But what deserves the strongest condemnation is not any transgression, it's the intentional transgression of known laws of God. And that's the point over here. Where the wrath of God is most commonly seen is for transgression of known laws of God. In other words, you knew better, but you did it anyway, because you simply chose to do it your way. Finally, in terms of God's holiness, God is perfect, man is not. While in the human dimension, God's relationship with humans, perfection is something that comes via the heart. You remember, perhaps, that David is called a man after God's own heart. And perfection comes because of the heart. David was not a perfect man by any means. In fact, David at one point in his experience with Bathsheba, David was just out and out in open rebellion against a known law of God. Not just what he did with Bathsheba, but then in arranging the death of her lawful husband, Uriah, in order for David to cover up the sin, the transgression, with Bathsheba. So you had not just one, but you had two major transgressions of the Ten Commandments in the case of David. And yet, David is a man that God refers to on several occasions as one after his own heart. He may not be perfect as God is perfect, but perfection in the sense of being committed to the heart of God, seeking the heart of God, is a kind of perfection that just does not exist otherwise. And that kind of perfection you find whenever you look at David as a man after God's own heart. Let's see, what was it? I told you I would tell you another example of law, I think, where with God it's absolute and yet it's flexible. But I forgot the example, so if it comes back to me, I'll tell it to you. So these are some of the distinctive aspects of God's holiness, of how God is wholly other, and yet God is also, so to speak, in our midst and with us. And because God is wholly other and yet still in our midst, you have a distinctiveness in that sense that just does not exist with any of the other gods of the other peoples in the time of the Old Testament. So these are ways in which the holiness of God is expressed uniquely With the gods of the other peoples, they're on maybe one side or the other side of this chart. Actually, they're all on this side, so to speak. But with God, He is both transcendent and immanent. He is wholly other and yet entirely here in the midst of His creation, and for the Old Testament, entirely in the midst of His people Israel, as represented by the cultists, as represented by the prophets, the priests, and the kings, as represented by the many acts of God that are performed on the behalf of the people. Another area concerning God has to do with mercy and redemption. Mercy is something that is effective, that's affective, kind of emotional in character. And redemption is legal in character. And this is something that, in terms of mercy, mercy is something that you see portrayed with God in a human dimension. So it's as a father seeks after his children, so God seeks after his people. God cares for the people whom he has chosen. And he delights in them. He worries over them. He has joy in them. And when they sin, when they make mistakes, he is willing to forgive them and to move on with them. And so mercy is a, it's not exactly an emotional thing, and yet in the same vein, it is somewhat an emotional characteristic. Redemption is an entirely different aspect of God, because redemption is really basically founded in the legal side of God and God's nature and His character and even His holiness. And so what you have in mercy and redemption are you have the union of love and holiness. Mercy springs from love that desires to redeem when people have erred, when they have made mistakes. And redemption is the way that you overcome transgressions of God's holiness. And so that's why I say it's the bringing together of love and holiness into one. And in understanding this, it's important to look at the concept of election and covenant. And so I want to talk for a few minutes about covenant, and then we may have a chance to get beyond just covenant to look at expressions of God's mercy, or else we'll do that in the next session. But in the Old Testament time period, there were several different kinds of covenants that were formed between different sorts of people. One kind of covenant was the kind of covenant where equals agree on something. And in that kind of a covenant, it's the kind of thing that we might tend to do today. Equals make an agreement to quit fighting. Equals make an agreement to work together. If you go shopping, technically, every time you go shopping, you make a covenant. We call it a purchase. But a person has something they want to sell, you have some money you want to buy, and when you reach a point as equals on a purchase price, you get the item and the seller gets the money. That is an agreement between two equals. And this kind of a covenant was, of course, very, very common throughout human history. But there was another kind of a covenant that was very common in the Old Testament period, and you see it in other historical periods and places as well. But especially in the Old Testament period, this was a very common kind of a covenant called a suzerainty covenant. And in a suzerainty covenant, you have essentially what is a great lord or a great king or someone who is very great making an agreement with people of lesser status. And essentially all of the agreement part is made by the greater one. So the great lord might agree to provide protection for your land and people, might agree to provide for routes for commerce, for goods to travel back and forth. The great lord might provide for education for your children and so forth like that. And what do you as someone of lesser status do? Your obligation is simply to be loyal to this great lord. And this is essentially a suzerainty treaty or covenant. And in a suzerainty covenant, what the great lord receives is from this person loyalty, this person loyalty, this person loyalty. And at the human level, that means that the great lord, the great king, does not have to worry about rebellion from this group of people, or this group of people, or this group of people. All of those with whom these suzerainty covenants are developed, the great king doesn't have to worry about them. Now, he may have enemies he does have to worry about, but these people are not going to attack him from behind while he is attacking his enemies somewhere else. That's the basic concept of a suzerainty treaty in the human dimension. Well, in the Old Testament, this is the suzerainty treaty, is the same kind of treaty that God made with Israel. Because God promised to provide for them, to redeem them, to give them bountiful crops and what would provide them with a good living and a comfortable lifestyle, and in every way to provide for them and take care of them. And the only thing that was required of them was to be loyal to God. Now, the loyalty involved the worship, obeying the law, and these sorts of things. But the only thing that was required of them was to be loyal to God. And so this kind of an agreement was the basis for Israel's election. And When God chose Israel, God chose Israel as an example of his love and care for the world. And he was demonstrating it through his love and care for Israel. And God gave them the law, he gave them the cultus, he gave them the ceremonies, he gave them the monarchy and all of these sorts of things to identify them as a people whom he had chosen to be his own. And this was the visible expression of his care for the people known as Israel. Under the terms of this covenant, all they had to do was be loyal to God.